Hello, everyone. I am Molly Wood, and this is Make Me Smart, your favorite podcast I know about tech, the economy, and culture, where none of us is as smart as all of us. Kai Ryssdal is on a reporting trip in Atlanta right now, and so we're trying out a new guy. Maybe you've heard of him, Marketplace's Andy Euler, senior reporter. Pretty much the closest thing we have to a sports reporter around here. Andy and I have like a long running occasional Slack.
True.
About all things sports. And he's joining us today from Austin.
Yep. Are you kidding me? Sitting here talking about sports with you, Molly, it's going to be good. It's going to be sort of that expanded version of our Slack. Hey, did you see that?
It finally happened. Basically. It finally happened. And it couldn't be more timely because we're talking today actually about the pending NCAA rule changes that would allow college athletes to accept paid sponsorships, make deals, and basically make money on their performances and their image. You probably heard that California already passed a bill in September that would allow college athletes to hire agents and sign endorsement deals. And that has been, I don't know, it's been a little bit of an earthquake in this industry, shaking things up.
Well, it's also extremely pending. We should sort of put that out there at the forefront,
yes.
Right? This is the NCAA saying, hey, we think this is probably a good idea, maybe. So we're going to kind of look into it, I think. But at least you're right. There is some momentum. And it's not just in California. There's a ton of other states. It's funny. Everybody that I talk to who knows a lot about this say what they're worried about is that other states are going to drop those lawsuits because they think what California did and the move that the NCAA has made is going to render those lawsuits sort of illegitimate or extra. And the worry is that the NCAA is going to come up with these rules and then those lawsuits are going to be gone and whatever rules they come up with are going to be the rules because the NCAA sort of works like that. But it has been building up. Students getting paid for being student athletes has been an issue for a long time.
Absolutely.
But there is at least a little bit of momentum and a little bit of a shift in attitude, it feels like.
Well, and a big reason for that momentum is that the student athletes themselves, one of whom we're going to talk to shortly, and you've seen pro athletes really speak out against this injustice. You have this, you know, I mean, it really is hard not to paint this as an injustice. You have a $1 billion industry. For a lot of schools, it's their main source of income. You have coaches with huge contracts. I mean, the incentives are all skewed toward a ton of money for everybody except the people putting their bodies at risk, doing all of this work, doing classwork on top of being athletes, really high-level athletes. So a lot of people are getting rich off students who cannot get paid, and the student athletes are saying, we're kind of over this.
So about a week ago, I did a story about this for Marketplace, sort of when the story broke, when the NCAA sent out that release. And I opened with an anecdote about Caitlin Ohashi because she was the person that sort of embodied this. She's a gymnast from UCLA. She did this amazing floor routine. It went completely viral. And she's actually been using that to spotlight the attention that she sort of thinks this deserves. A big issue for her and other college athletes was just not being compensated for that video, for her likeness, for what she was doing. And she was saying, hey, this needs to change.
Yes. And then she came on the show. We have Caitlin. Caitlin's been patiently waiting in our New York studio for us to finish all the throat clearing and start the conversation.
True.
And Caitlin, help us understand these issues. And thank you so much for coming on Make Me Smart.
Thanks for having me. And hello, everyone.
Let's dive right in about, you know, at what point, surely, this is a conversation that's been going on for so long. I assume that you had been thinking about it before this video really went viral. When did this start to strike you as a situation that just really didn't make sense in terms of student athletes and compensation?
Well, it's funny because I remember I came to college and it's like it's something that's been embedded for so long that you're kind of like, why would you ever try fighting the NCAA? Like there's so many things that were given, right? Like a free education. And so I never thought twice about it. And then I was dating a football player for a while who had his own clothing company and had to go through all these waiver processes and he couldn't promote anything on his Instagram without his eligibility getting pulled. So there were a lot of these underlying issues, and I started doing a lot of research my sophomore or junior year, and I wanted to start a whole organization at my school and try to expand from there and kind of boycott NCAA, and I was thinking of this lifelong project of creating an organization that basically mimics NCAA but doesn't exploit athletes. Mm-hmm. So I did a lot of research. And then my senior year, when all this happened, it just became even more obvious as to why we should be able to have the rights to our own likeness and name and image.
But that's a great point, too. You even sort of thinking about, you know, non-NCAA stuff. That's why people call the NCAA a cartel, right? Because this is the only avenue that student athletes have to participate in whatever they're good at. And so going around that renders sort of that competition in this current model obsolete, right? I mean, you had to have sort of thought about the pushback you were going to get, or if you were going to get any sort of play from another organization, right?
Yeah, no, of course there was going to be. And that, I mean, all the coaches get their revenue from NCAA, right? So the goal is to, how are you supposed to make enough money to make coaches want to come to you or schools want to come to you? So that would have been like the most difficult part of all of it. But now I feel like with this momentum, it's kind of the perfect opening for change in NCAA. But you're right when you were talking about how it's kind of like they're just looking into it, sort of. We don't know if something will actually be concrete with them.
Right.
And this is what they're known for, buying time and saying things that never go through. So.
And sort of acknowledging public sentiment, right?
Yeah.
Right. Like, we hear you.
Yeah, exactly. We hear you, but.
Well, yeah. And I feel like one really important thing that you pointed out in particular is that, you know, one of the arguments against paying, compensating college athletes is like, you get it, you have a chance to go pro. And then you'll get paid. And what you point out is that a lot of athletes, especially female athletes, don't have that option, right?
Exactly. Yeah. There is no pro league. And everyone's talking about how this will only benefit basketball or football players. But the biggest thing they're missing is that it's not going to just affect them. It's going to affect pretty much every sport and give us opportunities to, I mean, when we go to college, we all have the we're given an opportunity. So I feel like being able to even just have the rights to our likeness and be able to promote our other projects, like I was thinking about it, it's so messed up because NCAA basically only allows us to be one thing while we're in college. And then when the 4 years is up, it's like we're kicked to the curb. And they talk about how they help us on the field, out of the field, and after college, but there's none of that happening. So it's really interesting to see how many opportunities this will actually allow. Like, I know my senior year, I was talking about writing a poetry book, but I couldn't even vocally say that I was writing a poetry book without getting in trouble from compliance. So it's like, how can I go about this and promote myself as more than just an athlete and try to elongate my career as I graduate from college? And yeah, kind of an interesting space.
So I want to jump in to clarify one thing, because I don't think people realize the depth of what you're saying about likeness and compliance. Like, they continue to own the rights to profit off of your likeness and your name after you graduate, and you still can't. And even if you want to do a side project, help, Caitlin, how does this work?
No, and that's the problem, is like, we don't even know. So, for instance, my YouTube video, right, gets posted and has on YouTube around 50 million views. And so it's like, where is that money going? So if it's how it's supposed to work on YouTube, UCLA Athletics is the one that posted it. They should be getting all the money. And it would make sense if at least that money was seen going back to maybe UCLA Gymnastics or UCLA Athletics as a whole.
Instead of just a general revenue fund or whatever, right?
Yeah, like, we don't see that ever. So we don't know where that money went. Did it go to NCAA? Did it go to UCLA? Did it go to athletics? And then it's confusing for us because, we're the ones that are in the video and they're using our image name. And now that I've graduated, I still don't get to see any of that. And it's same for athletes that have their jerseys being sold and things like that. So 10 years later, when they graduate, they still don't see any of the money.
And you're not, we should be clear too. Sure, the running back, star running back for Alabama is going to have probably more opportunity than a lacrosse player at Syracuse. But what you're saying is those opportunities for instance, a women's basketball player at UConn could be really big. I mean, they're really successful. And so sort of this argument that it's going to sort of further make college sports, unequal, you just don't necessarily buy that. Is that fair?
Yeah, because the unfairness is already there. You know what I'm saying? Like, basketball mm-hmm. and football will always be a mainstream revenue-generating sport. So there's already that unfairness. I feel like it gives everyone a little bit more opportunities to utilize.
And does it seem like, you know, it's interesting because for years the argument was, should student athletes get paid? It right. seems to me like maybe this idea that you could profit from your likeness and do endorsement deals feels like a nice middle ground, like a reasonable compromise.
I would say it sounds very reasonable, but what NCAA has agreed upon is not even endorsement deals. It's basically being able to promote that you're selling clothes or something. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So it's kind of a very minuscule change that they're trying to blow up and make it seem like we're getting this extravagant deal. When it's like, it's pretty much the same thing.
Right.
The other thing, what's interesting is so many experts I talked to told me they think that it's different for you to get a sponsorship deal at a local car dealership relative to literally getting paid money for being out there on the field, that you can sort of draw that pretty easy distinction between paying for participation and being out on the field and sort of whatever you're promoting. It feels like at least the NCAA is acknowledging that. I mean, do you feel like they are?
Not really, huh?
That's the right response.
What is the counter argument? Like, as far as you understand, you know, that sure. when it comes to this idea of blurring the lines between professional and college sports, or that there are concerns about even more unintended consequences as a result of introducing compensation. Like, from your understanding, what's their argument against you getting paid?
From my understanding would be that, so if a company wants to endorse an athlete, maybe they're going to be more willing to just put the money into one athlete versus the whole school or the whole sport. Mm-hmm. So that's like my one thing that I've picked up on throughout my years in college.
Well, the other thing that I keep hearing about is sort of recruiting, right? That if you're the head coach at Clemson and you say, hey, we have a really sweet deal with Nike and I can set you up with a Nike representative, you know, when you come to campus, there's concern. And I think I'm the first to admit, I think this is probably pretty fair, that there is concern that those universities that have really, really deep pockets and are already sort of seen on national TV all the time, they're inherently going to get those star athletes to come to those universities because they're going to get paid for their images and likenesses. I think that's the biggest argument. But at the same time, those are the people who are out on the field. You know what I mean? Like,
I was going to say that.
That makes sense.
Then they probably, they're probably already a school that's in interest more so than other schools. So, right, mm-hmm. like there's still the kind of unfairness in it all. So, yeah, it does make sense.
I mean, there has been talk of a new type of league, right? Hasn't there? I feel like mm-hmm. there's an NBA player who's been trying to pioneer sort of a new type of league for college athletes or college-aged athletes. Like, is that the... Because I can say, sitting here not being Caitlin Ohashi, that I can sort of understand the idea that when you introduce money, you know, you've got one teammate who's really famous sure. and has a big Nike deal and others who don't, or that a program overall might not benefit in the same way from deals. But is it possible that what we really need to do is take this school out of the equation?
That's a good question. I feel like you'd have to. Yeah, I don't know. That's a tough one.
If you were going to do a separate league, you know? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I want you to go to college. I'm pro college.
Right.
Definitely.
But that was also one of the main arguments of that big lawsuit, the UCLA basketball star Ed O'Bannon in 2014 bringing that lawsuit about exactly this, right? The image and likeness of his jersey and why he wasn't getting compensated for it. The big argument from the NCAA was, look, go play basketball in Europe. You can, after high school, you can do that. So we're not, I mean, that was the idea, right? We're not telling you that you have to go to this college or you have to go to college and you have to participate in the NCAA program. But at the same time, like we were talking about earlier, that's where you get all of that, so those sort of accolades. That's where you get all of that fame. So of course you're going to go to school. It's sort of a backwards argument for, well, there are other options out there.
So that's why I think this is super important for states to start implementing, because then it forces NCAA to change. Like, yeah, sure, mm-hmm. they can take California schools out of NCAA, but with the more states following, it's kind of like, and plus, and California has like 50 plus schools that are in the NCAA. So that's a huge portion, and it's not really going to stop them. That's going to create more people wanting to go to California schools because they can right. see compensation. So that's why this is really extremely important to start talking about, because like you can see already NCAA's, you know, dipping mm-hmm. their toes, they're getting curious, they're starting to have to change.
You're saying states should not wait for NCAA to suddenly have a magical change of heart, that's not going to happen. It's going to take policy.
It's yeah, definitely. But it's also going to take a lot of kind of ironing out all of the implications and seeing the best way to make a middle grounds. Because of course, well, right,
as
like,
I sit here on the University of Texas campus, I know that if anybody's going out to California because of this new law, that's not going to be really widely accepted here at UT. So there is, it just feels like they're sort of opening up that pushback that we're going to see.
Wow. Yeah.
Love it. Caitlin Ohashi is a former UCLA gymnast, the recipient of many awards, hopefully some future endorsement deals. And if you have not seen her perfect 10 floor routine, you should go look it up right now. Now I feel kind of guilty, Caitlin, that I watched 100 times and you never got paid. But hope for the future.
It's okay. It's my amazing. Mom, too. My mom contributed to most of the millions.
Caitlin, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Let us know what you think, everyone. And if you are a student athlete who can relate to this conversation, please send us your perspective. We would love to hear it. Send us a voice memo at makemesmart@marketplace.org. And we want to hear from the parents of student athletes. If your kid will be affected by these rule changes and how you think this should evolve. And we will be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
Don Cherry, man.
Welcome back. Andy's like, I'm ready. I am ready for the news fix. I've been waiting for this part. He didn't put it in the rundown, but at least he told me what it's going to be. Yeah, your news fix is totally sports related, so you're going to start.
It is. It's very sports related, and it's a bummer. So what happened was Don Cherry has been fired from Hockey Night in Canada. This happened on Monday. He made comments on Saturday that specifically singled out immigrants for a lecture. It was kind of a lecture on the importance of patriotism. The language he used, there was a lot of sort of you people, you love Canada and you.
Hold on. Yeah. We should back up 1 second. Who's sure. Don Cherry? And what's Hockey Night in Canada?
I know. It's like me nerding out on sports. It's like, oh, come on, like, you guys.
Oh,
you're with
God.
Me.
Don Cherry was fired. And I was like, okay.
Okay, so Don Cherry's been around. It's funny because I have a Canadian colleague here. He works at KUT here in Austin. And we were talking about it. He said Don Cherry's been around. He's been with Sportsnet, sort of Canada's big broadcaster of sports. For 39 years, he's been on the air. So for four decades, this dude has been in people's TVs, in people's living rooms, basically. He had a show called Coach's Corner, where he would sort of talk about hockey, talk about whatever he wanted to. And then he was one of the color analysts on this really insanely popular program called Hockey Night in America. And it's on Saturday nights, and everybody turns in, and everybody sort of gets their taste of Don Cherry over the weekend. He used this platform to basically sort of call folks out for not buying these little poppy pens that support the troops in Canada and sort of recognize sacrifices. It's kind of the idea of, Veterans Day sort of mm-hmm. up there. He was calling out folks for not purchasing them. And then he specifically called out folks that are not Canadian, that are immigrants, because they enjoy what Canada is, the milk and honey, he said, of Canada. And you guys aren't buying poppies. And he was super upset about it. And actually, his co-host came out. The Sportsnet came out and apologized for it. His co-host said, I was sitting there and I was watching him and I didn't say anything, and I probably should have, because the language was divisive, and it was a shame. What my Canadian buddy was telling me is that, look, this is sort of what we were expecting to see from Don Cherry at some point. He's been boisterous. He's always sort of been a hothead. The bigotry certainly, it was highlighted this weekend, but everybody sort of, was waiting for this to happen. Unfortunately, it did. So now Sportsnet is in a sort of a conundrum, right? They have to figure out who's going to be on the air. He's a major star up in Canada.
Because clarify, they immediately fired him.
Immediately
the response was
fired
like,
him.
Nope, you're gone.
Yep. Yeah. And what's interesting, too, you're right to point that out, because a lot of times, especially here, we have that little bit of the murky period of, oh, you probably shouldn't have said that, man. Maybe you should maybe you can issue an apology or something like
maybe
that.
You should apologize. Mm-hmm.
Sportsnet was like, you're out of here, dude. That was it.
Right.
Good on them. So now they're sort of left scrambling to figure out, oh, man, we have this massive, massive hole. Every week on a Saturday, we got to figure out who's going to step in here.
Interestingly, my news fix is not about did not end with someone being abruptly fired, which I am frankly a bit surprised about.
Right.
I have two items as usual, because that's how I roll. But two astonishing things happened over the weekend that led me like deep into the Twitter rabbit hole.
The abyss.
The first, the first was Uber CEO Dara Khosrowshahi going on the Axios HBO show.
Right.
And being asked about Uber taking so many big investments from Saudi investment funds, and also having essentially, I think, a member of the Saudi government on the board.
Mm-hmm.
And he was asked about, how do you feel about this in light of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi? And if you did not watch the video, you almost have to, because I felt like the transcript of his response did not do it justice. What he said is that it was a serious mistake, the Saudi government allegedly ordering the murder and dismemberment of a journalist.
Right.
And then he said, we've made mistakes too. But the way that he, but you got to watch it because he goes, it's a serious mistake, right? He seems like dismissive, a little irritated. Right. He says, we've made mistakes too, like with self-driving, like that time, you know, that one of our cars accidentally killed a lady. I mean, he didn't say that, but, you know, we've made mistakes with self-driving and we stopped driving. We're recovering from that mistake. And he said, I think people make mistakes.
We all make mistakes.
Like Don Cherry, maybe they should be allowed to apologize. And
Come on.
Yeah.
Was he saying a lot more with his tone in his face too? Probably.
He does. It's the tone. Yeah. It's the tone in the face that are so important, I think, because it is this, I mean, it's a profound indifference that is demonstrated by his demeanor in this interview. He seems irritated by being asked about it. It's really a brush off. In no way he doesn't say, it's a serious mistake. He says, it's a serious mistake. We've made mistakes too. I mean, it's really, it's just astonishing. And then, you know, he sent an email later that said, I said something I don't believe. The murder was reprehensible. But look, Dan Primack, who's interviewing him, follows up. He said, there's a big difference between a mistaken code that caused a fatal accident, which, by the way, he never says is horrible, Dara.
Right.
There's a big difference between that and ordering the murder and dismemberment of a critic of your government. Wouldn't you agree? That's your opportunity, right? That's your opportunity to be like,
it's a layup.
Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe I didn't realize what we were talking about, but it turns out we're talking about a murder.
Exactly.
And no,
I misheard.
He does not take that opportunity.
Right.
I mean, it just was one of those moments where you're like, huh, I guess I see where the money comes from.
Wow.
And then my other quick news fix was about the Apple card. These were just like the two stories of the weekend, the Apple card
I was talking to somebody earlier about, all right, I'm going to let Molly talk about the Apple card because I know it's going to happen.
Oh my God. I mean, so, we can both talk about it because I bet you have thoughts. I know because, okay. So for background, I'm going to go back to the who is Don Cherry and what does he do?
Sure.
For background, there was a Twitter thread over the weekend from a well-known guy in the tech industry, the creator of Ruby on Rails, the programming language, who's pretty awesome on Twitter. Actually, you should totally follow him. And he was tweeting about how he and his wife both applied for Apple cards separately, and that despite his wife having much better credit than him and being a U.S. citizen, he's like, I have a way shorter credit history because I'm an immigrant. And, you know, she's got this really long credit history and she's a millionaire in her own right who now stays at home with our kids.
Right.
That he got a way higher credit limit than her. And he said, this is the result of a sexist algorithm. And he goes, and we called Apple customer support about this new kind of card that's supposed to be more transparent. And it's not, you know, it says it's like, it's from Apple, not a bank. And the Apple customer service people said, oh, it's just the algorithm, which is exactly the point, A, and B, a real banky kind of answer. Then, after enough complaining and tweeting, you know, they went ahead and raised her limit to match his. And she wrote this Medium post that said, all that shows is that rich people get whatever they want in America. Not that, you know, the system's any better. And then all of these people started piling into this thread. And this is what made it just incredible, saying the same thing happened to us. And then one of the people who piled into the thread was Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak.
There it is.
Who said, this happened in my household. I got a higher credit limit than my wife by a factor of 20.
Wow.
And that's unacceptable.
And so the argument, the counter, the retort was, this is just an algorithm, is it not? People
the
write
and
these
then,
algorithms. They don't write themselves.
Don't
Come on.
They're crazy, these algorithms. They do whatever they want. Yeah, exactly. No,
right.
People do this. This is why so many. And what's why I think this is relevant is that A, we are long overdue for a conversation about algorithmic bias. Plenty of brilliant people have been writing about this for a very long time. And B, nothing about this is a new kind of card that's not from a bank. Because what Apple did was turn around and say, oh, the problem is with our backend, Goldman Sachs.
Exactly.
And then Goldman Sachs was like, well, probably the reason that this happened, and this just blows my mind, is because a lot of these women who applied for these cards previously were just authorized users on their husbands' cards. I'm sure
Come on.
And I'm like, oh,
seriously?
My God. Yeah.
It's like, here's a hole. Here's a shovel.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's
incredible. I mean, it's a crazy story. And look, as we hurtle toward a universe in which all of us are sorted,
just robots,
assigned, ranked, and categorized by the algorithm, we might want to take a closer look on just exactly where that's coming from. There were so many things to be mad about this weekend.
Seriously. We'll be all right.
Okay. One final fix. Thanksgiving is coming up. And if you are currently, I don't know, comparing the cost of like driving versus taking the train, and you're wondering how a gallon of gas got to be $4 or whatever it is these days, I always can tell when gas has spiked because there's one station in my neighborhood where gas is really cheap. And when that one is like blocking all the traffic, I can tell that gas has gotten too high.
Hey, Molly.
Yeah.
Gas is like $2 here.
What? Stupid Texas. So awesome. Well, gas should be more expensive and then people would buy electric. How's that for a California
That's
answer?
That's actually a better argument, right?
We have a fresh explainer on gas prices on our Alexa skill tomorrow where Kai lays it all out. Just tell any Amazon device, Echo or otherwise, to Alexa, make me smart. And you can learn about spikes in gas prices and tons more topics from me and Kai whenever you like. There you go. I'm moving to Texas. All right, let's do the mailbag.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
If you have never heard this show before and you tuned into a random episode of the past 3, 4, or 5 months, you might think that we are a climate change podcast. It's my fault. It's my fault because it's my recent obsession. We talk about it a lot, but it isn't just us. Our listeners are thinking about this a lot, too. Here is a comment from someone calling herself Liesl the Traveler.
Hi, Kai and Molly. I wanted to thank you for talking about important issues. And Kai, thank you for giving voice to my pessimism. Your recent shows have focused a lot on climate change, so I wanted to get your opinion about the U.S. withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accords. It seems like the rest of the world and American corporations and states and individuals are still investing in green energy, and we're researching things like better batteries and changing our lifestyle. So do we have hope still to reduce emissions? Does the federal government really have to be involved for us to make progress on climate change?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, yes. I mean, it depends. It also depends on which federal government you mean. Yeah, nerd out.
Oh, no, I nerded out. This is basically, I went to policy school and studied environmental stuff. And so all we did basically was talk about exactly this. The sad thing is we also took a lot of economics courses. So the fallout was the market is going to dictate when these things happen. In this society, in America, when the market tells everybody, Shell, BP, whomever, that it makes a whole lot of sense to invest in wind energy and in solar, then that's when it's going to happen. I think that the government has to do something. The federal government has to do something to sort of goad that along. But sadly, and this sounds egregiously capitalistic to me, but when the markets sort of dictate that that's what's going to happen, that's what's going to happen. Is that? I mean, hopefully you're hearing exactly the opposite, Molly.
I mean, I am and I'm not. I think policy does matter. Like policy definitely, as you can see just from California's car emission standards, right? That is one simple example of a policy, government policy, that changed the course of a market. Like we have seen car emission and mileage standards change all over the world in large part because of one state's policy. And so it does, it does have a huge impact. That said, without doubt, when we talk to venture capitalists who say, you know, this is why we're not really in the game and there's not an obvious, like, even though in theory, the addressable market for investment in technology that can help mitigate or help us adapt to climate change is every human on Earth, right? That feels like a big, obvious market. What a lot of them say is that market won't move until either the risk becomes so big that they can't ignore it. And we're getting to that point when we talk about assessing risk of climate change. Or they say until there's a carbon tax, until, for example, returning to my earlier comment, the price of gas is high enough. Like I just found out actually that in the Netherlands, they tax cars by weight.
Hmm.
And so the incentive is get a small, very gas efficient
car.
Don't
buy an SUV. Right.
Right. Don't buy an SUV. And so that's an example of policy driving a market change, because the cost of then driving a heavy car is prohibitive. If there were a carbon tax implemented by the federal government, for example, then the cost of using carbon intensive materials or labor practices would be prohibitive, and you would be incentivized to go in a different direction. But again, you kind of have to have both. I think you have to have policy and market hand in hand.
Right. But sort of the federal government pointing fingers at other countries that aren't sort of doing what they should be doing, or pointing at China or pointing at India, I feel like I'm so tired of that, that that is sort of not doing anybody any good. The United States needs to sort of lead the way, and we need to figure out what we know what we need to do. We have so many scientists telling us exactly what we need to do. What we're doing is saying, you guys, come on, China, you guys are developing really fast. It needs to be a priority. I think this the listener is exactly right. The federal government does have to do something. I mean, that was a question, but I'm telling you, the federal government has to do something and sort of step up and lead the way, right?
Unqualified, yes. Yep. All right, what do we got next?
Our next comment comes from a listener in Kirkland, Washington.
Hello, Make Me Smart team. My name is William Wright. I love listening to your podcast. It not only makes me smarter, but also expands how I think about subjects. I enjoyed the recent episode about electric planes and the hurdles they have to overcome and the benefits that they'll be able to provide. What I keep thinking about is what happens during a disaster, hurricane, wildfire, tornado, earthquake, blizzard, or other major storm. What are you supposed to do when the power grid gets knocked out, or as we've heard about recently in California, it's shut down purposefully to prevent wildfire liability? I live in the Pacific Northwest, where earthquakes and major storms are a standing threat. I don't think I would ever switch to 100% electric modes of transportation. I would rather have a gas engine powering my evacuation, so when I do run low on fuel, the speed of refill is exponentially faster and the availability is much more probable. Thank you and keep up your amazing work.
This is a man after my prepper heart, because that's what I always say about having an electric car as my own vehicle, my only vehicle. I'm like, when the zombies come, I want to be able to suck gas out of an abandoned station with a straw and fill up my car.
Do you think that we said this about steam engines? That is my biggest question. Yeah. It's like, oh, come on, you're getting rid of the steam, y'all?
Right. I mean, there's an infrastructure thing there that could potentially solve that over time. But listen, like hurricane, wildfire, tornado, earthquake, blizzard, or other major storm, like there are plenty of studies that say that just regular old gas-powered flying, let alone electric, is going to be, you know, they say it's going to be a lot more turbulent, like the flight paths are going to have to get longer. So all of those are applicable to every method that we have for getting around.
William also makes a great point about sort of the viability of our grids, right? In ERCOT in Texas, we're always talking about it because it gets so hot here and everybody turns on their AC. Then you're worried about, can the system, I mean, literally you read every day, can the system take it? I mean, if we're talking about that all of the time, and there has been a lot of talk about sort of figuring out how to redo the grid, how to re-sort of structure it, we talk about it. But until it fails, and this sounds really pessimistic, but until it fails, then we're not going to do anything because everything's fine. And it kind of feels like climate change generally, right? Until things get really, really bad, it's like, everything's fine. We're going to make it.
It is the story of human history. Ironically, that is like the perfect lead-in, actually, to the Make Me Smart question, because it's by Dan Carlin, who you may know as the host of the Hardcore History podcast. I can't believe Kai's not here for this. He'd be so excited. And he has just written a new book called The End Is Always Near, Apocalyptic Moments from the Bronze Age Collapse to Nuclear Near Misses, which I can't wait to read and get super more paranoid about. But he also called in and answered the Make Me Smart question, which one more time is, what is something you thought you knew and you later found out you were wrong about? Here's Dan Carlin.
When I was a newly minted news reporter, I was sent to cover the appeals trial of a man who had been convicted of murdering a convenience store clerk in my community. At the appeal, the prosecutor, working with a bunch of different experts, put together a case that seemed ironclad against this defendant. And the key to the whole thing, and the entire case sort of hinged on this, was the blood spatter evidence and the expert on that who testified at the trial and who said there was a better than 99-point-something percent chance that the murderer was sitting about 5 feet away from me every day in this courtroom. I mean, it was an open and shut case, and I remember thinking I would have convicted this person had I sat on the jury. Fast forward several years. The defendant has been sitting in prison, and a person comes forward and confesses to the crime. He did it. And then he promptly killed himself after attesting to it in a note. Well, once the police went back and plugged this new person's name into all the evidence, they fit even better than the old person who was currently in prison for the crime. And that person was released, given a cash settlement, and allowed to go on their way. But I never forgot it. And I asked myself many times afterwards, was I witnessing the lone example? Or was this something that could be happening elsewhere all over the country in courtrooms? And is it something that could happen again in my community? I've kept a more open mind about that, but I hope and I think it's made me a better reporter ever since.
So appropriate to everything we were just saying, too, which is that you think you know a narrative.
Right.
Until there's another one that makes even more sense. Man, I love this. That question, once again, is what is something you thought you knew and you later found out you were wrong about? You can email your answers to us at makemesmart@marketplace.org. And thanks for listening. Subscribe to the newsletter. You can find it at marketplace.org/newsletters. You will not miss a beat. Andy, thanks for coming
Molly.
On and sports reporting with me.
Oh, this is so fun. Yeah, no, this is awesome.
Make me smart. I know. Love it. All right, let's do a sports show. Okay, bosses, write that down. Make Me Smart right. is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. Our senior producer is Jody Becker. Thanks to our video producers, Ben Hethcote and Summer Dunsmore. And thanks to Cynthia Betubiza for helping with video in New York.
This week's program was engineered by Jay Siebold. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez, or Dan Ram, as I like to call him. The executive director of On Demand is Sitara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark.
Who I'm sure immediately wrote down our sports podcast idea.
Oh, she had to have.
Yeah, she listens to that, and she told us.
Nailed it.
Oh, I know. I just came from Dallas, actually.
Oh, really?
Beautiful Dallas, Texas. I grew up in Fort Worth.
Really?
Yeah.
I lived there for like 6 years, so.
Did you really? What part of Dallas? Now the judgment starts.
Plano.
Okay. Now the judgment starts. I'm just staying out of this part.
I mean, I had a cousin who went to Plano Senior High.
Wait, that's so literally where I went to high school.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Casey O'Connor.
Oh my God, you guys are related.
You're way too young.
I knew it.
We're actually.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.